Tech Podcast. My name is James.
And I am Drew O'Grizzick. How's it going, James?
It's going well. How's it going, right. Drew?
It's going great. Thanks.
So we were just talking earlier about a change in my schedule.
Yeah.
And I've actually been paying attention to this framework called Vue 2.0 or Vue.js. It's something that I've been using quite a lot on different projects. And I've been paying attention to when this new version came out because I really like this framework a lot. It's sort of like the poor man's React almost. It's something that I've used to like augment my sites and augment anything that I build on like a website or whatever to make it more interactive, to add like nice events and templates and all this other stuff that you would get from something like Angular. And I was actually paying attention, waiting for the new version to come out because I was thinking, oh, you know, it'd be really cool if I could not to just learn the framework, but also have another project out there would be to build a Udemy course around learning this framework. And so I'd look at the docs and try to make an example of each one and try to teach that as if it from someone who've never used it before. And unfortunately, my schedule's you only have so much time in a week. And so I've decided to leave the show to try to work on this course, this other side project.
So this brings a couple of questions to me. The first one is there a better way we could describe Vue other than saying a poor man's React? Because that doesn't necessarily put it in the best Vue.
No, yes, exactly. So. Nice pun. But yeah, I guess it doesn't put in the best Vue. I think that what I mean is like you can get invested with very little effort, which is like one of the best things about it. So I know with a lot of React stuff, it does require a lot of augmentation to your build process, especially if you want to use like nice things like ESX and JSX. Where Vue, I just include it as like it was just a link to a CDN and a script tag, and I can start using it on my page. And so I don't always use it to like, I'm not using it first to build my app, whereas like you probably want to think about React as a really, really integral part of your build process. I mean that from like writing your code to actually releasing it into production. Whereas Vue, a lot of the time I'm using it to like make the experience a lot better. So it's not about starting with Vue and then building from there, whereas React, in my less experience than maybe someone else, but in my very short and very academic experience, that you'd really want to start with that as your building block and then build from there. Like, we're going to use React, so we need to make these decisions before we even start.
Right.
Whereas like Vue, a lot of time I can just add it on to something else, not like Angular. You just add it on to improve things or really change maybe a little bit of, you wouldn't use it to like overhaul the whole thing. Although you can, that's not typically how I would use it. So
okay. So yeah, it's kind of interesting in that the docs look quite good for Vue.js as well. I was just at vuejs.org looking through it. It has a nice section like what is Vue, and there's a link to comparison with other frameworks, which includes React, as you probably would imagine. It's got performance profiles and JSX versus templates, things like that. So definitely worth a read and a flip through. So something like this, like looking at Vue, you're saying Vue.js 2.0 just came out or very recently came out, and you're like, well, let's build out a Udemy course on this. What sort of time investment are you looking at for something like that? Like, how long do you expect to take to build out a course?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I know we both took the Go course, or like went through a little bit of it, or at least used it as a learning point for learning Go, and that one had like 150 videos.
Yeah, which is not necessarily typical of what you'd expect from a course. And I can't think of the teacher's name right now, but
it was Scott McLeod.
Scott McLeod, and he keeps coming up with more and more materials, and I think that's really, really interesting. He's definitely passionate about what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that 150 videos sounds like a lot. I don't think it would take 150 videos to go through the core of what Vue would be. Right. Maybe if I added like a ton of examples, which is something that I really want to do. I've done a few like courses, and a lot of the time they're very, I'm doing an ES6 course right now, which is really good. It shows you a lot of the new features, but I like to see things like in practice, like, I'm sure you probably agree, but it's nice to see what something is described as how to use it and then show it in a use case, which I find a lot of videos might go through. They're showing features. They're not showing use cases.
Yeah.
Like, here's a new feature that you can use, like, array in ES6. You can turn something into an array or check if it is an array. Okay. Well, when would I use that? Let's show an example as well. So I like the idea of show the feature or teach the feature, show an example. Teach the feature, show an example. So I expect to take, I'd like to, you know, I think 30 videos or up somewhere up there would be great. Even more, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how the video length or the number of videos impacts the sale of the course, because it is a paid, you pay to go to take the course.
Didn't they recently make a flat payment method, or so now it's like every course is $10 or something?
Oh, I haven't seen that.
I think they made a change. I'd have to verify that.
Yeah, because I know that you and I did. We both use some promo codes, because promo codes is a big part of their business model. It's actually looking at the teacher sort of guideline. Mm-hmm. It says that a promo code will increase your sales by 93%.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting. So the reason I signed up for that Go course was because you said you got it for like, this great price of blah, blah, blah. And I got it for like way less than that.
Yeah, you got it for like five, like half of what I paid. I was like, oh, man. Yeah.
I thought you paid like 150 or something.
No, I think it was like $10 or something. Okay. Or maybe you paid $10 and I paid like 50 or... Yeah, I think that might be I think that might be true. Like, it was a significant difference that you were able to save, which is pretty great.
So now, yeah, they do have something. They've done something called Simplifying Udemy's Pricing and Promotions. So how does pricing work on Udemy? All courses are priced between $20 and $200 each. Global prices here. Mm-hmm. So both instructors and Udemy provide different discounts, but a course may never be discounted below $10 US.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Cool. Yeah, I guess so that'll be something that I'll have to find as well, or do some sort of research with, like, what should the price be? How much should I ask for based on time I've invested? Like, how am I happy about the output of the course? Mm-hmm. I might even try to get some friends of mine to sort of like check the videos, make sure they're not too far advanced or too beginner. Like, I want to have a happy medium between that, which is really tough. You know, you kind of have to pick someone to target and really work at that person. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a good experience to sort of get that all going, as well as like something that I've never done before, and I'm really excited to try it out.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'm just looking at some of the JavaScript courses that they have, and it looks like there's pricing all across the board. So we see everything from like, one of the ones, JavaScript for absolute beginners, is like $25. Mm-hmm. JavaScript for beginning web developers is $80. And they both have 4.1, 4.2 star ratings, respectively. Then this other one, JavaScript advanced web programming for $50. It doesn't, just from the ones that I'm flipping through, there's like pages and pages, but it looks like a lot of the, I searched for JavaScript as well. Mm-hmm. They're just JavaScript and not necessarily frameworks. I'm not sure.
I think there's a bunch of React stuff if you looked around. There's probably Angular stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, the stuff that's really set in stone as like a de facto tool for a given job that you want to do. A lot of that stuff has courses that are aimed at those particular skills and developing that. So
yeah, modern React with Redux, $185.
Have you ever used, what's the one that Google has all their courses on? Udacity, I think it is?
Code School?
Yeah.
Oh, Udacity.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Have you ever used Udacity?
Mm-hmm. I think that was actually in conjunction with somebody from Google or something like that.
Yeah, because you can get a bunch of certifications through Udacity by watching all these videos. You like build apps, you like do, you learn about Google services and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really nice. Like, the pricing seemed fair for the amount of information in there.
I was actually quite interested in like online educational tools for a long time. So I looked at a bunch of the different ones and kind of tried some of their courses. But Udacity, I really liked how, I think they were one of the early ones to have like interactive video. So they had like a intro to comp sci course was one of their first ones. I remember going through that, and it was Python, and it would go, you know, there'd be a section of video, and then you'd have, and I guess they were just using like JavaScript over your, like an overlay.
Oh, nice. That's cool.
And so you could, answer the questions right there and kind of do some programming as well.
Oh, that's cool.
And I think it worked. That's actually something I think that's really interesting, is that like online education works particularly well with technical subjects like computer programming,
right,
where you have testable inputs and outputs.
Yeah, right? I couldn't imagine taking like a history course through video, although I'm sure there's
history
some out there.
Maybe like as long as you have something that's testable, such that you would know the exact answer, right? Like, if you have a multiple choice thing, as opposed to like, imagine how difficult it would be to automate the grading of an essay.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Versus a multiple choice.
Yeah. I guess it's a lot easier to test that your code outputs the correct answer.
Well, you can write the tests. Yeah. You can write the tests for the code, yeah, and then they just have to make it pass.
It's hard to test an essay on, like, what was the War of 1812?
Yeah. But you have to ask the question in a specific way as well, right? Like, given this input, give me this output, and then you can very much test that.
I found that, like, reading an article is great. Like, sometimes I'll retain the information, but if I've watched a video on it, I find I retain it so much more because I can, like, picture what the result or what the thing I was thinking of in my head because I've seen it in action. So I found that if I'm trying to think about an article, I'm like, oh man, what was that thing? But if I saw something on Laracast, which is another like video service that I subscribe to, they were teaching about Redis and using like atomic increments and stuff like that. So you can like dynamically increment things without having to say, get it, plus one, send it back. They have dynamic properties for that. So I'm like, oh, there's this cool thing. And I was like, oh, I can use it on a project. And I remember how it was used and how to set it up just because I watched someone do it and heard them commenting on it. I feel like I retain that a lot more.
That's a really good point. What were the best online educational experiences you've had based on maybe best interface or best usability or just simply the best course?
I really like Laracast. It's not necessarily a single course. Mm-hmm. It's a series of videos about Laravel and also PHP, but then they also sprinkle in things like Vim. They have like a Vim course on how to use Vim or a Sublime course, how to use Sublime. I mentioned the Redis one. Mm-hmm. Even things like how to use Solid Principle to like make your code more effective or more even like patterns in PHP, like using the subscriber pattern or the singleton pattern, all these type of things. I don't know if there's any particular one that stands out at the moment, but I do like, there was one that I was watching about the Solid Principle one, using Solid. Now, ask me what Solid is. I'm not sure if I'm going to get all of the acronyms right, but there's single responsibility, open to, extension, close to, changes. I is... I forget. L is someone's last name, and then D
is before I.
L is before I. L is the Lipschultz something principle or something. Is that what it is? Something close to that.
Liskov substitution.
Yeah. And what was I?
I is interface segregation and dependency inversion.
D is dependency
segregation. Yeah.
D is dependency inversion.
I mean, it depends, right? I use any of this stuff really depends on the day.
Yeah, sure. And then obviously I didn't remember it 100%, but it was interesting to see that. And it was really clear and nicely laid out. So watching someone talk about this stuff and showing examples of when to use it, why not to use it, all that stuff is so nice. One thing I like about video as well is that sometimes in an article, it's so the example is very contrived. It was like made up to show a particular action. But in a video, sometimes one little thing goes wrong and you're like, oh, I forgot to show you this one thing. Or, oh, this is why I got this error. So I find the video is a lot more relevant to maybe how you would actually do the thing that you want versus like following steps in an article, because there might be little tidbits that come up in the video that you couldn't communicate effectively in an article.
I was just actually reading a little bit more on the dependency inversion principle while you were saying that and thinking, like, do I actually do this on a day-to-day basis? And so it says the principle states a high-level module should not depend on low-level modules. Both should depend on abstractions, and the abstractions should not depend on details. Details should depend on abstractions. And this is kind of interesting. I don't think I use this very much, to be honest, and I probably should take a bit of a closer look. How about you?
I try to do the single responsibility thing. Like I made, I'm working on a project right now where we have this little search thing, and it basically just does searches a couple tables and then combines the result at the end. And so I just made a class called Search. Mm-hmm. The only thing it does is query. It actually only queries one model, and then it returns with the results from that. And it can handle a couple things. So you pass in a request, a PSR7 request object, which is in PHP, they have these PHP standard recommendations, and they have speaking of dependency inversion, they have an interface for a request. Mm-hmm. And you, as long as you pass something like that in, it'll handle it internally and spit back out the results you want. And so that one has literally a single responsibility. It searches. I should actually rename it to like search songs because that's all it does. So that I like. And it has no dependencies, which is great, other than like the model with the ORM, which makes sense, search song. But maybe I should split it out. I don't know. I guess I try to. I don't think about it that much. I obviously haven't remembered the acronym. So maybe I should go back and see if there's something I could do to improve that. I don't know about yourself. You're saying that like it's something that you want to. Are you going to try to make some differences or make some changes to how you do things?
Well, with regards to dependency inversion specifically, I'm not too sure.
Just the whole Solid. What about the open to, extension, close to, changes?
The modification, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it really depends on what you're building and how you're building it at the time. So those, a lot of things sound really good in practice, mm-hmm. or sound really good in theory, and would be really great to have in practice, given certain other things, like time constraints or luxuries. And then other things are like, no, regardless of how much time you have or don't have, you know, like, I can't remember if I mentioned this before, but I remember somebody saying something along the lines of, you know, I don't have time to automate this process.
And
thinking like, wow, that if it were automated, you'd have a lot more time.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But, and I mean, even that statement, as ridiculous as it might sound, given the cost of automation versus the time it takes to perform the task, mm-hmm. it's not always going to be good to automate it upfront.
Definitely.
And I think the same thing's true with a lot of things. So right now, with some of the things that we're looking at, we've been changing things so quickly.
Yeah.
And I think having those re-architecture design meetings mm-hmm. are pretty interesting. And so, like, if you're still in the stages of kind of, I guess, feeling your way in the dark in a somewhat new industry, and the business itself doesn't have set in stone requirements,
right,
then it might not always be the best time to say, all right, let's do the upfront design first.
Yeah.
So I think we end up with a really interesting mix mm-hmm. of, like, I'd like to say we're following good practices, but I do find sometime that we find, you know, very interesting edge cases where we don't have tests that cover a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the, like, from next week, one of the things we're going to be spending a lot of time on is getting things properly tested as far as the integration tests are concerned.
Yeah.
Unit tests are still something we're like, well, you know, we haven't been so far just to get things out, and we've been moving things so quickly that refactoring all the tests because everything changed would be a pretty big amount of time that we just don't have. Even if that is 20% more time mm-hmm. or 50%, depending on the case, we don't have that, right? And so, but if that ends up costing us time later, which we're getting to a point now where we're starting to see, like, oh yeah, it might be, you know, finding little edge case bugs because you changed one thing over there, but there was some dependency that you didn't realize somewhere else that trickles down.
I think something you can do, and I would agree 100% with what you said, like, there's not, if you're iterating all the time, and like at Invoke, we're building some products sometime, and every week we're changing the requirements.
Yeah.
So like, am I going to change, now I have two files to change, like I have the model or the class and the test.
At least two.
And then maybe I'm changing an integration test, so now I have three times the amount of work, whether that's like,
have to make sure that you've cleared that you're clear on what it's supposed to do now.
Right.
Because now you've changed this, there's the other thing is it sounds like a very reasonable change within the context of that entity, but there may be other things that are expecting that not to change.
Right, exactly. And that's where the test can help you, but then changing it is like very, very painful.
Well, that's just it. And then if you don't have those tests, then changing it, it's not just painful, it can provide bugs that you're like, wait, what? How is that even related to that?
My approach lately has been, we'll write a test when a bug pops up.
Yep.
We're like, oh, that's weird. That shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Let's write a test, recreate the case that will fail, and refactor the code till it passes. So then I'm not writing a test for every like method or every new feature or every new integration path. I'm just writing the test for a known bug, and hopefully I have the hindsight in when that thing that caused the bug is removed eventually, if we do some iteration where that feature is removed or changed, mm-hmm. hopefully we can go back, but it'd fail anyway if it really affected it.
Well, I think it's quite reasonable to add tests, you know, for your bug fixes.
For known bugs,
a lot of sense, because then you know that that's unexpected behavior, and then you have an idea of what the expected behavior is, and that makes a lot of sense, and that's kind of usually tempered by at least a few different sets of eyes.
Yeah, definitely. So I found that helpful. Also, you write less tests, which is like means you work faster.
That's kind of interesting. Like when it comes to if you have maybe a legacy system mm-hmm. that doesn't have any tests and maybe isn't really implemented the best, do you say, hey, I'm just going to scrap this whole thing, re-architect it, build it from the ground up? Yeah. Or do you say, you know what, I'm building out this new feature which touches upon these things, and these things that it's touching upon would be a lot better. This feature that I'm working on would be a lot better if these little things were cleaned up a little. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll clean up the edges, but I'm not going to dive too deep into the the underlying.
And I think that's a perfect case for like a one-off test for, I'm refactoring this one global function or this one method or whatever.
Yeah.
I'll just write a test just to make sure that it, just to test that its current functionality, make sure that it currently works the way that it should. Mm-hmm. Then I'll make my change, run my test again. If it passes, great. If it fails, I did something wrong.
And then, yeah, I think like the thing with that is you're at least writing a test for the thing that you care about.
Right. I'm sure everyone on the team would be really in favor of that. What about my thing? I care about my thing. Yeah, cool.
Interesting. Okay, so that all brings us back to the lack of time that you're now going to have,
right,
and less or no James on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Yeah.
So where does that leave the Vancouver Tech Podcast?
I don't know. I think we'll have to find a suitable co-host. Or I almost like the idea of the floating co-host, although it probably would make it difficult for you to be able to book multiple people all the time. So I'm not sure what the deal would be there. So
we'll figure out something, I guess. Like a floating co-host does seem like a pretty cool idea, because then you have like that extra guest that's also a guest co-host.
Right.
So then it would be effectively two guests a week. One being the co-host and one being... That's kind of neat. Maybe a couple of co-hosts that you rotate between.
Yeah.
So you have like, you know...
Regulars.
Three or five. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard feedback on our last episode, and people... I heard a couple and they were like, oh man, I really wanted to keep listening.
Mm-hmm.
And trust us, we know we really wanted to keep talking. We just ran out of time with Charles and Adam.
Yeah.
So
well, I think there was like... There's so many things that we wanted to talk about, and... We literally did run out of time.
They
came by to the window and we were like, hey, it's time to go.
Hey, it's time to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. You want to jump to
meetups around town.
Cool. All right. So this week is Thanksgiving weekend.
It is Thanksgiving weekend. That's kind of neat. Do you do anything special for Thanksgiving?
Not necessarily. I think the schedule with my girlfriend is clean a lot. Buy some furniture, organize the closet. Like it's about, we're doing our sort of, I guess, fall cleaning to sort of get rid of some stuff that we, one of the things is that we moved like here almost, I guess, 16 months ago or so. And well, I think one of the things that I've noticed is I have bags and boxes that I've never even opened.
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe I should just throw out the whole box and not even look inside. Because I obviously never even touched it. In an entire year, an entire 12 or 18 months passed by and I didn't even touch the box, look inside it. Should I just get rid of the whole thing?
That's so interesting. You might never even notice what's in there if you do just do that. But you also might miss out on that $50 bill in the pocket of your
jeans. It's like, I threw out a hard drive. No.
With my Bitcoin.
Yeah. With a bunch of Bitcoins on it. And I went to the landfill to try to find it. Yeah. Hopefully that won't happen. But
that's a really good question. I periodically do similar things, like go through my stuff and get rid of things that I don't need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Yeah, it's a good point. If you haven't touched anything and you haven't noticed it for almost a year and a half, maybe you're not going to.
Yeah, cool. But what about yourself? Anything fancy for the long weekend?
So I've been kind of mulling. No, nothing planned per se. But I had been mulling over the idea of inviting people over and doing a turkey thing.
Oh, nice.
Or just doing a turkey thing and not inviting anybody over.
Yeah.
So
private turkey.
Pajama day or...
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's nice. Definitely.
We'll see.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Looks like we don't have much happening on Monday. The GitHub and Zero Tech does have probably auto-posted, but I'm pretty sure it's not happening.
Okay, cool.
So let's jump over to Tuesday the 11th. So this starts out pretty early. With open coffee, I'm actually surprised, and I would maybe be a little bit surprised if this does happen as well.
I'll comment and ask if this is still going on, but we'll see. It is at 8 a.m., so very early on Tuesday morning at Nelson the Seagull.
It is Tuesday, which isn't a holiday, so maybe it's not surprising.
We'll find out.
Yeah. And then here's one that I hadn't seen before that I thought was pretty cool. Maybe I have, but Django Van. And this is the Django Vancouver meetup group. I've actually been somewhat surprised with how little I've seen Python in some of the meetup groups and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought it would be quite a popular language. And I think even from the survey that you did.
It was like three or four on the list.
So it's kind of nice to see this. This is the F Up night in October 2016 meetup. So it looks like it should be pretty fun. So they'll have several Django developers on hand to present their stories of failure. hear about mistakes, bad code, embarrassing errors, and maybe laugh a little too. Sounds cool. Pretty cool. And then also an awesome talk using GraphQL with Django. And that sounds really cool. Nice.
Yeah, cool. All right. And the Clojure Hack Night.
And the Clojure Hack Night. So this is from 6 p.m. over at CodeCore. Make sure to bring a laptop to this one and be ready to hack on some Clojure.
Cool. All right. We have a BrainStation meetup. Intro to User Experience Design Workshop.
Yeah. So this is from 6 to 8. And it is over at BrainStation, which is 1110 Hamilton. It's a $20 cost. And it looks kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And let's jump over to Wednesday, the 12th, where we have
the Vancouver Linux Desktop Meetup.
Oh, right. So this is from 4:30 to 6:30. I think, James, you were saying something about maybe putting Linux on your MacBook.
Yeah, I have this MacBook that I'm using right now. It's a 2011 MacBook Pro. My girlfriend also has a MacBook Pro that's old that I was thinking of throwing a box on there or a distro on there. I did try to run Ubuntu or Debian or something a while back, and I ran into that like boot problem where the bootloader was locked. And I just didn't have the time to debug that, so it'd be nice if someone could give me a little hint and a little help, and I can get around that. So I'm thinking of getting a new laptop, so it'd be nice to convert this one to a Linux box.
What kind of laptop are you looking at getting?
Probably just a new MacBook. I've been tied between the 13 and the 15, because I know the new MacBook Pro is coming out soon. So what I want to do is, as soon as the new one comes out, I want to buy the top-of-the-line refurbished one, the newest one I can get, and then just stick with that. Because, I mean, this 2011 MacBook Pro is 5 years old now, and I've been fine with it. So I'm hoping that if I just buy another top-of-the-line MacBook Pro Retina, just refurbished version, then it'll last me another 5 years, hopefully, or at least two or three before I have to buy a new one.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, I was kind of hoping for a... you know how Adam has his Chromebook Pixel?
Yeah.
I think he's got Ubuntu on there. And that's pretty cool. It's like a nice little piece of hardware and everything.
Yeah, definitely.
And I was looking at HP actually has a pretty nice Chromebook 13 G1. Mm. And that's like an aluminum housing. And it looks pretty nice. And that's about, I think it's about $600 in the States, though. So I don't know what it would be up here. I guess that would be about $1,000 up here. Probably.
Were you thinking of getting something?
I was thinking of maybe getting something like that for like specifically to run Linux on.
Oh yeah.
But I don't know what some of the changes to Chrome OS, if that's going to be worthwhile or not. But I think the one of the big things for me was, and I could just do like a key mapping thing, but I tried out a Chromebook for a while, and I remember one of the things was just, you know, SSH. I'd end up always SSHing into my desktop, you know, and I'd have like a terminal session in the browser, and then so I'd be in Vim and I'd press like Control W to do something, and like my
window would close.
And I was like, aha, I just lost my session.
Oh man.
Like, I was using Tmux, I think, so it wasn't a big deal or anything, but it was still just like kind of annoying. And sure, I could play around with the key mappings, but it's just little things like that I was like, why even bother? But also, that was a cheap Chromebook, and it just didn't feel very good.
You could probably do the alternate version of that, which would be buy the hardware and install Chrome OS if you wanted to, because I think you can. I've seen posts around that you can use the Chrome OS image and install
it. Well, I don't. I really don't.
Like that. Oh, you don't want Chrome OS?
For me, it wasn't about Chrome OS at all. It was about just having like a cool...
inexpensive Linux box, I guess.
Not necessarily inexpensive, even. Just like something cool to run Linux on that feels good. So that's one of the things... So I guess here's my take on this, is that... like MacBooks feel so good.
Oh yeah,
they're a nice piece of hardware.
Yeah,
and if I'm running Mac OS, it's a great operating system. So I don't need a different operating system on it. So it just seems kind of weird to me to run anything else on a MacBook.
Yeah.
If I had a different laptop that actually felt good, and so the one that I really like. There's like a really nice Lenovo one, like the ThinkPad. It feels really good. It has nice keys and whatever. Yeah. But it's just really expensive.
What?
It's like $3,700.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And is it aluminum too?
No.
Oh. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the aluminum and the like the metal and stuff. And once you get into the plastic stuff, I just feel like that's gonna get ruined. Like it's I don't mind
that. Like the keys are definitely plastic.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I mean the body is always like a huge point of contention for me. Like
well, something that I like about the aluminum, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so, is that it keeps things much cooler inside.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's quiet. It's super quiet too, which is nice. All right, Linux Desktop Meetup. Check it out. Now we have the Tech Talent Meetup.
Yeah, so this is over at the BC Tech Innovation Hub, 887 Great Northern Way, from 5 to 7:30 p.m.
Yeah, and it says it's asking for developers, QA, UX, IT, product, and product manager specialists looking for their dream jobs. So you would check this out if you fit into one of those categories. Lots of companies there: SAP, Traction Demand, ACL, TaskTop, D-Wave, HyperWallet, VivaNet, GroupHealth, MeetingMax, Arista Networks, Fathcom, Focus, Prism Media, tons of stuff.
So you might what would you describe as a dream job? What would be some of the ingredients of a dream job?
I summarize it as this: more of what you love, less of what you hate.
Okay.
So that would mean you're just doing things that you like to do and less of what you don't like to do.
Well, what about for James? I mean, what would be some of those?
So, yeah, I recently changed jobs. So for me, it was I didn't want to interface with clients as much as I was. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my day like writing emails, reviewing work that other people had done. Although it's not so bad once in a while, but that was my entire day sometimes. Like, I'd spend half my day on phone calls, writing emails. It's just something I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make stuff, write code, build things. And so at my new job, that's exactly what I do. I do a little bit of management on the side, but it's just the perfect amount that I wanted.
Right.
So in the new job that I have is more of what I like, less of what I don't like, which is exactly what I was looking for.
That sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So maybe you already have your dream job.
Yeah. What about yourself?
For me, I think that definitely, like you said, having some interesting problems or kind of hard problems to build solutions for is a big one. Something that has a team that I like collaborating with.
Oh, yeah.
I think it is also a big. But then also things like having time to work on projects that I really want to work on. Mm. So let's say, for example, I think one big thing would be having the ability to come up with multiple versions of a solution and test which one or ones work better.
Yeah.
I think it would be an ideal part.
It's like applying the scientific method almost.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we have three solutions. Let's see which one works the best.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Tech Talent Meetup. Check it out.
Awesome. It does look like it's sold out, though, so check it out next time it happens. And if you already have a ticket, have fun.
Be sure to go if you have a ticket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we got the Pluralsight Study Group. So this is from 5:30 to 6:30 on Wednesday over at PNI Digital Offices, 100 425 Carroll Street. Make sure to bring your laptop and your Pluralsight subscription and have some fun. What are they working on this week, James?
Quick Start to JavaScript, part two.
Nice. So that looks pretty awesome. I wonder if they know about Vue.js.
I don't know. I should check it out and see. I should check Pluralsight to see if there's anything on there.
Yeah, I think I'm going to check out the Vue.js docs sometime over the weekend because you got me interested now.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so then we have YVR testing. This is over at Sophus, 580 Granville from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And this is quite a good meetup. So it says here, companies with social impact, Plato testing.
Oh, this says 3 days ago.
Where did this come from?
I don't know. Maybe this was left on from last week.
Oh, yeah. Maybe this was left on from last week.
Okay, we'll just jump over it. Do you want to do the next one?
And then we've got the .NET user group of BC. This is happening over at Microsoft. That's 1100, 1111 West Georgia from 5:45 to 8 p.m. Would you bring a laptop to this event, James?
Yeah, I would, because it's called Building Mobile Apps with .NET Using Xamarin and SharePoint.
Oh, interesting. But it does also have a speaker.
Yeah, it does. I don't know if I'm going to hurt this guy's name, but Yaroslav has been involved with SharePoint solutions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it does say this: in this session, we'll help you get started building and loading apps on your phone.
Cool.
So this is kind of neat. Building mobile apps with .NET using Xamarin and SharePoint. So I would bring my mobile phone as I would anywhere I went.
Good point.
And I'd also bring my my laptop. I wonder, like, is this going to be? I'm guessing you probably want to have Windows because it says Visual Studio combined with Xamarin to start. I'm not really too sure, but SharePoint Online will be used as an example data source.
Cool.
.NET skills. Probably going to have something, have some .NET skills for this.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Another friend of the show has a meetup coming up, the Learn Data Science meetup.
Oh, yeah. So this is at SFU Venture Labs, 555 West Hastings, suite number 1200. And it's from 6 p.m. Make sure to have read the reading. What was the reading this week?
It's called Gaussian Processes for Time Series Modeling.
Nice. So that looks like it should be pretty awesome. Doors open at 6:30. The reading group starts 7:45 off to a nearby restaurant for food, drinks, and breakout discussions.
Cool. All right, another cool one coming up, the Vancouver Amazon Web Services User Group.
Yeah, and I think this is maybe the longest meetup group if we don't expand the acronyms in the
right.
The DCKRSES practitioners. Yeah. So this is Trinimbus, Suite 280, 1401 West 8. Would you bring a laptop to this one, James?
I think so. I would probably take some notes. They're talking about Elastic Beanstalk in depth, so you definitely might want to check out some of the stuff that's going on there.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be breakout sessions or anything like that. It does say from 6 o'clock, snacks and mingling, 6:15 presentation. The skill level, it says, is intermediate. So it looks like AWS Elastic Beanstalk in depth. Definitely bring something to take notes with.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a computer so that you can dang stuff out as you're going over it. But it's probably going to be, I'm not sure, but I would guess it's somewhat of a higher level overview.
Sure.
But it might be just like a walkthrough as well.
Cool.
Should be pretty fun. All right. And then we've got from 6:30, Style in Class. Over at Microsoft Canada, that's 725 Granville. And Styling Class, this is a kind of neat meetup. What's this one all about, James?
This one's called Inclusive Research and Design.
Yeah.
So they the general idea or from the description is they want to take the design process the best they can and actually forget about, you want to try not to forget about the portions that are applicable to your audience. So that means basically paying attention to what you're actually designing and making sure you're inclusive with that design.
Right. And it does note that there will be an assortment of beer and soft drinks will be provided, no food. And also 19 plus, minors will not be permitted due to alcohol service.
Okay. Last one on Wednesday, Van Bug.
Yeah, from 7 p.m. And this is over at SFU Harbor Center, 515 West Hastings. And this is going over the material for the BSD Associate Study Guide for Exam Prep.
Cool. I find it nice that people are working together and studying to all get certified. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's really awesome. Okay, and that's it for our Wednesday. Then we've got Thursday. So we start out with the DDD CQRS ES Practitioners Meetup.
And that's actually at Decentral. We've talked about this quite a bit. Decentral's, I think, changing its name to Decontrol, I think. At least we talked with, on our last episode, Adam, who is the organizer of this meetup, mentioned that Decentral's becoming Decontrol. That's at 436 West Pender Street, of course.
And then we've got the Big Data University Meetup from 5:30 p.m.
Yep, this one's called The Data Behind Massive Open Online Courses.
Yeah, this looks kind of interesting. It doesn't have the location announced yet. It's got a TBA, and so we'll see where that ends up being. But it does sound pretty cool. So the data behind massively online open courses, these are pretty cool. So I thought this might be pretty fun. There is register by RSVPing on Meetup and registering here. So there is a place to register as well that brings you to bigdatauniversity.com, which I'd never heard of before.
There's actually free beer and pizza, or pizza and pop as well.
Free pizza and pop. Woo. All right. Then we have the Mainland Advanced Security Meetup over at Central City Brew Pub, 871 Beatty Street. And this is from 6 p.m. Have you been to any of their meetups before, James?
I don't think so.
I haven't.
Yeah.
And so this is the monthly Vancouver's premier monthly hacker security professional meetup.
Cool.
Yeah, should be kind of neat.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the last one on Thursday, we have CodeCore's Demo Day. So this is CodeCore, 142 West Hastings Street. I wouldn't worry about bringing a laptop to this one. This is from 6 to 9, and you get a chance to see what some of the students at CodeCore who've been working for the past 12 weeks on their course and all their projects.
Yeah.
See what they've been able to put together and get to see them demo that. So if you're interested in maybe taking the course yourself, or if you're interested in hiring someone, one of their grads, or if you're wondering, you know, would one of their grads make a good hire? What can they produce? Then this would be a good opportunity to see the type of skill level.
Yeah, I've been to this before and I was really, really impressed with all the students. So definitely check that out.
Nice. Yeah. And then we've got Friday the 14th. So it's the Spring U Demo Day happening at the Spring Basement, 211 East Georgia. So 211 East Georgia, I guess that's in Chinatown.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, the Spring Office. I think that's like right beside Ramen Man.
Ooh.
Or Ramen Butcher, rather.
Oh, yeah. So definitely check out the Ramen Butcher as well, because that place is awesome. <It's pretty
good>. But this is from 6 to 9 p.m. on Friday. And what's this all about?
So this is their – SpringU has a – it's sort of like an incubator. Mm-hmm. They actually work closely with a lot of companies around town. So they actually mentioned that they have 280 entrepreneurs come through their door and about 190 jobs or companies launch and actually – hire people, and are, this is part of their demo day, showing all the different things that they that happened during this event and during their incubation period. I think it'd be cool to go here if you were thinking about joining a company, maybe looking for a job, or even just looking at some of the new companies that are coming up as well.
Very cool. Check out. Okay, and then Saturday, Decontrol, formerly known as Decentral, over on Pender, they're having a hackathon from noon to 11:45 at night on Saturday. And that looks like it's going to be pretty awesome. So the location is only shown to members, but you probably know where it is already.
Yeah.
And it says here, we're going to be working on the space all day. We'll be working on projects we've been neglecting. Make sure the space is in order and properly maintained. Free pizza for all those who help. Woohoo!
Sweet.
And looks like that's our week in Meetups Around Town. All right, and we're here on the Vancouver Tech Podcast with our special guest, Klaus Salzner.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for coming. We're really excited to have you. So you're the VP of Engineering over at BuildDirect.
Yeah, that's correct.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about that. What's your day-to-day like? What's BuildDirect like? I guess that's a pretty interesting place to work, and you're on top of the building, right?
Yeah, we're on the 19th and 22nd floor. So let's talk a little bit first about BuildDirect. So we have been around for about 16, 17 years. Mm-hmm. Started out as an e-commerce vendor in the home improvement industry. So home improvement meaning anything I need to build a house, renovate a room or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the last couple of years, we have been really focusing on building that platform for the home improvement industry. And what we mean with that is connecting suppliers who want to sell directly to consumers and enabling consumers to have a much richer selection how they can renovate their room and whatnot.
That's really, really cool. So if I am a homeowner and I want to redo my kitchen, but I don't want to pay someone else to do it, I want to do it myself. Would BuildDirect be a place that I would get all my info and my supplies and everything?
It would be a perfect place to do that. We actually provide a design tool, so you actually can go and do a design of your kitchen, and you can look at it in a 3D model and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then you can find the products. You can get samples, which we ship, and then you can buy the products, and we ship them right to your door and help you to get them in your house and whatnot.
Really awesome. Okay, I don't actually have any tools, so I probably need tools as well. Would I get that from BuildDirect too?
No, we do not try to be in this in the tooling or on whatnot. We're really trying to provide the heavy goods which you need for renovation, right? So tiling. We try to go into things like ovens, fridges, and whatnot. So right now we have probably around 150,000 products. Our goal is to have about 1 million in the next year.
Oh, that's quite a big jump.
And, that's a very big jump, yes. We're very aggressive on that.
So I guess BuildDirect has been growing quite a lot. You'll have to expand your team, maybe expand the office. Is there any plans for that?
Yes. So we are, tech is about 110 people. We grew from about 10 people to 110 in about two and a half years.
Oh, that's huge growth. That's so BuildDirect's been around for quite a while, I guess. But suddenly explosive growth.
Once we started to shift doing everything ourselves, but really building the platform so that we can enable suppliers to run the business on our platform, that's where we really then started to have aggressive growth. So we took a bunch of VC funding. Mm-hmm. We grew from, again, 10 to 110. Overall, we're about 300 people. And we grew from a couple of 10,000 products in 6-9 months to about 100-120,000 products. And then again, we have very ambitious goals to be at least 1 million SKUs, because it's really important to provide a large selection to customers, right? So you find more flooring and sometimes the special flooring you're looking for, and then give the right tools to the buyers to find the right products, right? Because what Home Depot does is they narrow down the selection. They only give you 100, while very often customers have different tastes. So we often compare ourselves to the music industry, initially very constrained supply, And now you can get millions of songs, and really the consumer can choose what they want and not someone else for them.
Right, right. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of, I guess, so going back to the, I guess, the example that I had of, you know, I want to remodel my kitchen. So now I might have various, maybe I want two different cupboards.
Definitely.
I could do that.
Yeah, you can actually use our design tool to play around how you want to position your cupboards, where you want to have your oven and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then you can go off and say, no, yeah, I want to have this type of flooring. Mm-hmm. And then you can say, give me a sample, and we'll ship you a sample within 24 hours. You can actually look at it. And then you can, again, on the side, you can start playing around and searching, right? There's different types of flooring. There's different types of cupboards. And then once you are closer to what you want, you can call our customer experience team. They will help you and whatnot. And then ultimately, you will buy the products and we will ship them to you.
Cool. So who's the so the customer is an individual or maybe a couple or whatever who is renovating their house, but is there also like contractors or larger companies? Do they also use BuildDirect as well?
So today we're actually focusing on the homeowner, and there's two different or three different types. There's one which says, I want to select the products, but I'm going to have a contractor who does the installation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or they do it yourself. They do the buying, they do the installation, they know it all. And then also contractors, right? So that in the future, we will allow you to find contractors and you can explain what your dream kitchen is and they will help you finding the right products in our platform and they will help you installing it and whatnot.
So I could imagine contractors already using the product with their customers.
Yes.
You might not even know that that's what they're doing, but they might be doing that as well.
We actually have a contractor program.
Oh, okay.
And we have like hundreds of contractors throughout North America. And we expect to be having thousands and whatnot. And in the future, we'll have contractors, home designers, architects. So any role which is kind of related to building and improving your house in the future would be using our platform.
Very cool. So you mentioned before your customer experience team, and I guess they would be working with all of those types of customers, then your end consumer, your contractor, and so on.
Yeah, our intention is to be driven by the platform, right? Mm-hmm. But then once people are at certain stages of their endeavor, they want to get some advice, right? And if they can't get it through the platform, we're like, just contact us, whether it's chat or call us, and we will give you help, whether it's what type of flooring to look for or whatever your question is. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we also want to connect the consumer to the supplier so that the supplier knows the product the most, that you can simply ask the question of the supplier. I see this floor. I have this and this question. Can you help me? And the supplier would help you making that selection.
So I actually see that not only do you have your headquarters in Vancouver, but you also have like tons of warehouses sprinkled throughout the United States, as well as one here in BC. Is that going to grow as well? Is that how you get the products to people so quickly?
Yes. So we actually provide to the suppliers, we provide a supply chain services. Right. So we have different types. Some supplier have a whole network in North America and they are like, you know what? I have my own warehouse. I ship it and whatnot. But we also have a lot of suppliers. They're based internationally, like in Asia Pacific, and they have no infrastructure in North America. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're like, don't worry. Just ship the product into our warehouse. We will optimize the distribution.
So the platform is much more than just software platform. It is the whole like inventory infrastructure for North America, at least.
Correct. When you look a little bit what Amazon does today, they're doing the same thing, right? They're providing warehouse services. They're providing shipping and trucking services. They're building a whole supply chain for their goods. Mm-hmm. The key difference for us is that FedEx, UPS, and Amazon, they are playing in the space of lightweight goods, right? It's simple to ship a book or a CD, right? We show up with flooring, 2,500
pounds. I don't know if it's that simple to ship a book or a CD, but I mean, it's comparatively. Sure.
It's a whole challenge by itself. Don't get me wrong, right? It's a difficult problem, which they really know how to solve.
Mm-hmm.
but you have a different focus when you ship a book versus when you ship flooring, right?
Right.
It's a whole set of different challenges.
Right.
When we started out 15 years ago, we saw, well, okay, there's a supply chain we can simply tie into, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go to FedEx and UPS and they're telling you 2,500 pounds, no, I can't ship this, right? Or they tell you, well, you need to deliver it curbside or you need to help it getting into the building. We don't have any of those services.
So are these some of the types of problems that your dev team might be solving? Things like routing, things like, you know, transportation of large goods.
Yes, we actually have our engineering team is structured one focused on the buyer side, so consumer and whatnot, one focused more on the seller suppliers, and then one focused on supply chain. So we're building out that system where, for example, we know which routes the good can go, and we select the either the cheapest or the fastest route based on what the customer need is.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard some interesting things when it comes to routes. I think someone claimed that Purolator, I'm not sure if that's correct, only makes right turns, for example. You know, and I'd heard some talk on this. I think it was. I'm not sure if it was, I can't think of his name, but from, there was a local company that did Routify, I think, something like that. And they were working on kind of optimized routes. And I saw an interview with one of the people behind that. And they said, you know, maybe this was just a marketing ploy that Purolator had. But have you heard things like this?
I've heard things like this, right? So when you go back again to UPS and FedEx, it's not the driver who chooses the route.
Right.
It's actually software which tells the driver, this is the route.
Mm-hmm.
And as new orders come in or new drop-offs come in, in real time, the system tells the driver, no, go there first and there first and whatnot. Our is a little bit different again, right? Because we are, again, shipping heavyweight, right? So we, for example, can't go certain streets and whatnot. So it's a different optimization. But yes, today, most of the delivery routes is really picked by software and not by humans anymore.
That's quite interesting. And
yeah,
I guess it does bring a lot of unique challenges that you might not normally have a chance to even think about. But when you look at it, could be pretty interesting. So what are some of the other maybe challenges or problems that some, you said three teams, what are some of the problems that they might get to solve? You might not normally think of.
Yeah, so again, we can look bucket by bucket, right? So for the consumer side, we are applying a lot of machine learning algorithm at this stage. So we actually watch everything a consumer does. We know every product you look at. We know every product you click on. We know every product you put in the cart. And we use those data signals, as we call them, to drive real time which products we're going to recommend to you, right? So you click on one product, you see it, the next product you're going to look at, the machine learning has already learned which products to recommend, because based on what we learned, this is what you as a consumer are looking for.
So is that type of I guess that type of machine learning algorithm, is that something that must be kind of developed in-house, because products are different, consumers are different, platforms are different? Or is there some sort of overlap and some sharing that can happen with other industries?
There is there's certainly machine learning algorithms are out there which you can leverage. We had a lot of conversation in-house, and we chose actually to build our own machine learning because, again, we think that the home improvement industry is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And we, like Amazon, we think that this is going to be one of our secret sauces in the future.
Sure, cool. Yeah. Sounds really interesting. I'm really looking forward to maybe seeing some open source or some meetups discussing things like that.
Definitely.
But okay, and then what about some of the other buckets?
The routing, which we just discussed, right now we're working actually on a graph database, how we can represent real-time what the routings are, and then real-time we would start adjusting the route based on what's happening in the business. So again, we're applying machine learning to the routing. Routing and actually calculating shipping costs is also quite interesting. In the heavy good industry, you can't quite simply say, what it costs me always $5 to ship this, right? Because today I order flooring, tomorrow I order a fridge, and both of them are not going to be cheap to ship. So we're actually applying machine learning how, based on historical shipping costs, we can predict future shipping costs, and that's what we're actually showing to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in what happens when I click that checkout button.
what's the next step? What kind of, can you talk me through what kind of happens behind the scenes as far as like how it goes from an order that's placed to it shows up at my door? Because it is a big, heavy item. I was curious how that works.
It is. So during the checkout process, when you click on checkout, the first thing we're going to, again, real-time calculate for you the shipping cost and whatnot. You would go through the regular thing of providing your payment information and order is placed. And then goes into our warehouse system, right? And then we would package the goods up. We would ship it to the customer, and in the background, there's a warehouse management, TMS management, and a whole routing and whatnot, which is running behind the scene.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and then eventually it'll show up at my door, so...
It magically shows up. And for a consumer, it looks very simple, right? I just click the button and it shows up. Behind the scene, there's a lot of magic happening.
Now, are there other things, like, let's say I order 15 items and I can't start my project unless I have 7 of those 15 items. Are there ways to optimize that sort of delivery from the customer's point of view?
Today, we're still fairly simple. Those use cases you're talking about, again, are things we want to do in the future. Especially also, we haven't yet started doing a lot of business with developers, right? So, for example, what if someone wants to build a high-rise, right? I need 1,500 bus stops, 300 today, 300 in 3 days from today, right? Mm-hmm. We're experimenting a little bit as we do more business in that. Yes, we have to enable those use cases.
Right. I guess that would be a lot more relevant when it comes to actual contractors working on deadlines and things like that. And so that's something as well, like, you know, all of these ideas that you might think of, like, oh, this is a good idea, that's a great idea, might not actually materialize into a financial sense because that might not be how everyone's using it. Are there any things that you could identify as some surprises for how your platform has been used that were maybe some areas that were very successful that you didn't think would be or the opposite?
Yeah, so first of all, we have really that culture which we're instilling of experimentation. We really try to start out with, we don't know all the answers. We know what a possible answer is, and we're going to experiment. We're going to look at the data, and based on the data, learn what customers really want to do. It's a really important aspect for our culture.
Right.
So things like... customers referring other customers, right? It's quite surprising which other types of customers people refer, and that that by default means a much higher chance of conversion than buying someone through an ad is an interesting learning, right? Mm-hmm. The whole routing, how when you really drill down how the trucking industry works and which days which trucks are going and what constraints they have, there's a huge amount of learning and surprises in there.
Yeah, I can imagine. So that sounds pretty fun. Tell us a bit about the tech stack that you're using and the choices maybe behind that.
Yeah, so we try to be a polyglot engineering organization. And what I mean with that is we're not... where we come and say you must use Amazon AWS and you can only use .NET. We're like, based on your need as an engineer, choose the right tool. So today we run on both the Amazon and on the Microsoft Azure platform.
Cool.
So certain pieces run on those different cloud platforms. We use BHP mostly for the seller supply chain side. We use Python for that design tool, which I talked about, the 3D rendering and whatnot. And then the buyer and supply chain side is mostly written in .NET and Node.js.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So have you found any problem with having the mixed thing? Is it been really beneficial having mixed a technology stack? What were your opinion on that be?
So there's a lot of discussion in the industry about this. I find it beneficial, right?
Yeah.
Because, for example, when you look at Amazon and so the AWS and the Microsoft Azure platform, they're not equal. And sometimes this cloud platform is a little bit ahead, and then next time this one is again a little bit ahead, right? So based on what you need is choose the right platform. So when, for example, we introduced a message bus and whatnot, we saw the Azure message bus was a little bit ahead of what the AWS is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
versus using maybe something else like RabbitMQ or
maybe something like that. We also have the mindset that we want to only use cloud services. We don't want to be in the business of hosting and maintaining and running stuff. We simply want to subscribe to a service and off we go.
Now, is that just because you don't have the time, effort, desire to invest into those things, or just because you don't need to?
Nowadays you don't need to, nor do we have the desire. We would have the ability, right? We have a cloud ops team. For sure. They could run whatever we want, right? But today you just don't need to.
Mm-hmm. I guess there could be a point somewhere where it becomes more cost effective or less cost effective.
Sure.
But I don't know exactly. I guess you'd have to be...
You have to be at a much heavier scale, but then also you look at other players, they run large scale systems in the cloud, right? Mm. So if there's going to be a point of time where it makes sense to run certain components ourselves, we would have no problem. But today, we just don't envision that need is really going to arise.
That makes sense. So I guess that frees you up and allows your resources to really concentrate on the problems at hand. And I think you kind of mentioned a little bit about what those were, which sound really interesting. And it doesn't sound like too many technologies either. I mean, Python, PHP. So you've got like kind of more scripting sort of languages.
Yeah, I wouldn't go crazy, right? Having 20 different technology stacks is going to be, there is an overhead, right?
Right.
You need to find that balance. But what I personally find is having a reasonable amount, 3, 4, 5, whatever it turns out to be, is actually a big enabler. Once you go too crazy, then it becomes too much of a burden again.
Yeah. Do you find a lot of, do people change teams or work on multiple products?
Yeah, so we encourage that. So we are very transparent in what is going on, what we are focusing on. And if someone says, well, I really want to work on this machine learning thing, we're like, yeah, okay, we're going to accommodate that. We're also trying to instill this continuous learning and improvement, right? Mm-hmm. So we encourage to say, oh, you don't know this quite, right? Spend the time to learn it and whatnot.
Right.
Do you find it's easier to hire if you have this more variety of languages and positions in terms of different stacks?
Yes, there's actually two things which are really important for me. First of all, yeah, as you said, if I have a little bit broader set of technologies I use, it makes it easy to find talent. Mm-hmm. But we also have found that engineers which have worked on multiple platforms, they just bring a broader set of experiences and design patterns and practices into the organization. So when I hire, I prefer someone who has worked on two platforms versus one platform. But it's not an absolute must, but we're preferring it.
So that was actually something I was interested in asking, was what are you looking for in engineers? Are you looking for someone who's had experience with these particular technologies, or with maybe with a wide range of technologies? Or
yeah, I think the industry has evolved over the last 10 years from a checklist, this is what you must have, to more like, what are your experiences and best practices you should bring along, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're really good in Node.js and have a little bit of .NET experience, that's a perfect talent for me, or vice versa. I'm looking more for what is your own culture, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have that mindset of that I want to learn something new?
Right.
Once you have worked on one or two platforms for a couple of years and really have that mindset of continuous learning, learning a new technology or new platform is an easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, which is pretty much a given today, is the technology I'm working on today, 5 years from today, is going to be irrelevant.
Right.
Do you find that the growth of these languages or any other new languages coming up that you think would be a good candidate for anything new that's being rolled out?
Yeah, I mean, it's again a plus and a challenge, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you look in the front end, like every other week, every month, a new JavaScript library comes along.
Right.
So it's hard for engineers to stay on top of that. But we encourage experimentation, right? So we were originally using more Angular. As some of the new engineers came in, they really liked React. We experimented, and now we're moving as a whole organization more and more adopting React because it just feels more natural to us.
Cool. So was that more of just maybe a personal personal cultural preference, I guess? Or were there sort of testable reasons why?
There were definitely testable reasons and whatnot. First of all, we prefer a more lightweight framework. Mm-hmm. Has the disadvantage you might have to do a little bit more legwork yourself, but has much more flexibility. The other things we like about React very much is the front-end versus back-end rendering, right? Mm-hmm. It makes it very seamless. So there's a lot of really good reasons why we chose it, but it was driven by engineers from the ground up, right? There was no, like, tomorrow we need to go there. It's engineers started a conversation, they started to experiment, we saw the value, and let's just do more of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I know we have there's a bunch of positions open on the BuildDirect site. You mentioned that the team is growing pretty rapidly. Was there anything specific that you're really looking for in these people, or is it really a very broad approach and then it gets more narrow?
We are looking particularly in three types of roles at the moment. We're looking for experienced product managers. Mm-hmm. We're looking for experienced dev managers, and then experienced engineers. And engineers can be either really on the front end, full stack, or back end. So those are three roles we're really trying to focus on at this stage.
Cool. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the BuildDirect meetup.
Yeah. Sure. So we started that about 9-12 months ago. So we tried to bring people in and just have a meetup and really exchange experience. And we always want to start with our experience. So, for example, we had a meetup about product management. What are some of the things we're doing? What are some of the struggles? And then try to engage that community. We had meetups about marketing, about growth. So we tried to use our experience and our challenges and bring that to the community. And that's a great way how to engage people. It's a great way to also for BuildDirect to learn stuff, right? It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, hey, you're doing this. This is great, right? Mm-hmm. Let's try it out.
Cool. Nice. That's pretty awesome. So what about yourself, Klaus? Do you attend many meetups around town?
Yeah, I attend some of them. A little bit challenged by the fact that I have two young kids. Yeah. That makes it a little bit harder.
Definitely.
But yeah, I really try to have that same mindset of continuous learning. So I like to read books, like to blog. There's a whole bunch of stuff I have up on my LinkedIn profile. I like to attend meetups. And I hosted some of the BuildDirect meetups sometimes.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds really good. So if people want to reach out to you, what's a good way to get a hold of you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. Those are probably the two best ways. So Klaus Salchner, Salchner, is the best way to get hold of me.
Awesome. And we'll have links to your Twitter and LinkedIn down below.
Great.
Awesome. Well, Klaus, thank you very much for being on this episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I really, really appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the VanTech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us, show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups
around town.